It's September 26th, 2011, and this is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fail-free living. That's advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery, what are we calling this episode?
The one with the PC build, or I'm a PC, or where do we get off telling people how to not let technology ruin your day? ISP ate my life.
Right. This episode was originally intended to be about building your own PC, and we still intend to talk about that. But something significant came up in the past week. How long have you been dealing about this? Just take us through this whole story.
Well, I think it started not last Saturday, but the Saturday prior. Started having some intermittent issues. My cable company, Mediacom, I decided that I was tired of paying for basic cable service because I never watched the TV.
Sure.
And so I wanted to cancel it. And of course, this is a big deal to them because if you cancel basic cable, they charge me $1 more a month.
Because you had some bundle before?
Yeah, I guess. And the reason they do that, I think, is because they can't actually take off basic cable. Like, you get it no matter what, right? Like, even without the service, I was able to get the high def locals and all that stuff.
Well, I think that's some sort of government mandate, is that you have to get the
Well, I think that that if you have cable at all, you have to, anything that's clear QAM, like the unencrypted HD stuff, they have to send.
Yep.
And you know, I'll have to revisit that later at some point, but so I canceled service, and there was a big brouhaha about that because they didn't want to do it, obviously. And then so it was this whole big production, and they told me they were going to send someone to my house to do it and that they were going to charge me money. They said, well, it takes like $18 for a service call. And I said $18 for what? And they said, well, we have to send the technician out to put the filter on the line. And I said, that sounds like your problem. And he says, well, that's your problem. That's why we charge you. And I said, well, that sounds pretty ridiculous, but you go ahead and feel free to bill me, and we'll see if I actually pay you anything. And they said, well, we don't have to. I mean, I'll do you the courtesy and not, you know, charge you the $18.
Okay.
So they send someone out, and this idiot puts the block on, and from that day forward, and that was on the, you know, nine or 10 days ago, and from that day forward, my cable internet service was up and down, off and on, all the time. So, like, I would come home from work, and it would be, you know, 5 o'clock, 5:30, walk in the door, and I'd take a look over at the cable modem, and it was, like, flashing at me. And then I would, like, unplug it and plug it back in, and I'd do that a couple times, and then it would come back online for half an hour, and then it would drop off again. And throughout all this, I called the support people at Mediacom and asked them if they could take a look at it, and they said, well, you know, has anything changed recently? And I said, well, yeah, as you can see, I've canceled the basic television service, and that's when you sent a technician out, and that's when it all stopped working. So after a little bit more back and forth with them, and they sent someone out, and the problem was that I was in this like a conference that lasted like 2 days on campus, and so I was in meetings all day long, so I couldn't be meeting people to come over and like poke at things. And ever since everything was going to be outside anyways, I was like, well, I don't need to be there because
they don't need to get inside the house. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, clearly the problem is outside.
Yeah.
Cause that's where you guys were, you know, with the wrenches and the digging around and the freaking
out.
And
they never came in the house to put the filter on in the first place.
No. Okay. It was all outside at the pole.
Yep.
And I can't remember what they call it, but it's like that little box that's out on my neighbor's front lawn. And they said, oh, well, you have to be there for like liability purposes. And I'm like, yeah, well, first of all, that's ridiculous because it's actually in my neighbor's yard. And it made no sense to me, but I eventually had some back and forth, and that's that Monday night, it still was down. And that's when I sent you a message and we had to bag the recording. So from that point on, I started sending out messages from the Hell Yeah Show's Twitter feed, which, by the way, is available, but not a lot has happened in the last week except for me going back and forth and raging on Mediacom.
And in fact, the Mediacom raging is the only thing on the Hell Yeah Twitter feed.
Yeah, and it was, I think, after 5 days of this that I realized that Alan was also getting all of the emails that were being sent every time we got a response from Mediacom, who was trying to steer the burning plane.
I enjoyed it. I was I, I was sitting back and watching all this go down over the past week.
It's me versus the world. So as I'm talking to them back and forth, I've also already placed an order for service from Quest. So I've already kind of started the wheels in motion to move to Quest for DSL service.
So are these the only two sort of traditional ISPs in your area?
Yep. I can do Mediacom for cable, and their highest tier of service is a 24 megabit download and about 2.5 megabit upload.
That's not bad.
No, the upload speed's great.
Yeah.
The service has just always been a little dicey. It halts a lot. Sometimes it will just kind of, nothing will happen for a little bit.
And you had mentioned previously they hijack your 404 pages as well.
Yeah. So that's the real issue that I've had with them too. And they have this moronic opt-out process that never works. You're supposed to be able to exclude your residence and your account from this 404 hijacking and redirecting, but it never works. And the person from Mediacom on Twitter was like, "Well, has this really impacted your service? Do you think that are we doing something that are we preventing you from seeing things that you would want to see?" And I said, as a matter of fact, yes. And I knew they were being a little smug about it, or I thought that they were, because it's kind of a dick question to ask.
Right.
And so they're saying, and I said yes, because in a lot of cases, if you go to a site and the page is gone and you get a 404 page, it might also have navigation cues on that 404 page that will help you kind of get back to where you want to go.
Yep. I did that on all my sites.
Yeah, but not if you're a Mediacom customer. If you're a Mediacom customer, you would get presented with ads that are, best case scenario, marginally relevant to one of the words that you have in the URL that you're searching. it's always terrible. So, Quest came out. They did the turn up. I got service set up with them on Thursday, but I had some in-house wiring and connectivity issues to sort out. So the best I can get from Quest in my area is 20 megabit down and 860K up.
That's also not terrible. I mean, that's working.
Now, the upload speed kind of stinks. And so far, the only time that I've ever really felt like it was holding me back is when another topic for another show, I think, might be how I do all the machines in the house, we use Unison to do synchronization to our NAS. And then every night, shortly after midnight, the NAS runs a job that encrypts the documents for my wife and I and shuffles them off to Amazon S3 using software called Duplicity.
Nice.
And it's great.
Yeah,
Not super easy to set up, but when it's set up, it's very reliable and has been working really well.
But besides that, you're not hosting any web servers or machines like that?
No.
On property?
Nope.
Okay.
Everything I've got is either at Linode or at EC2.
Okay.
So, and I also have an Xserve and a rack and a colo in Virginia somewhere.
That you've forgotten about?
Yeah, because I've been so busy with the other machines. But so the downside was is that it had been 20 some odd days or whatever since my last full backup. So good test case. Saturday night, I think, a Duplicity job ran and decided that it had been long enough and it needed to do another full backup. And it took about 8 hours to upload 4 gigabytes to S3.
Wow.
Now, that sounds like a lot, but then I also have to remember that first of all, my NAS is a RediNAS NV Plus, and it has a really super ancient, junky UltraSpark CPU that takes forever to encrypt anything.
Okay.
And then it also has to go out to S3, and the way that S3 works is it's kind of pokey and it does everything in chunks, right? So it has to do these 25 megabyte pieces, and there's some added latency there. It's not like I'm doing a direct upload all in one go. So that all took about 8 hours for the full backup, but that also includes the time that it took to compare the local metadata and the remote metadata and encrypt and decrypt and then decide what needed to go and put it all up there. So the upside is that all this happens at night, so I don't really care.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be okay.
Okay. And are there, either on your old ISP or your new one, are there any bandwidth caps?
No.
Okay. That's really good.
They don't do any metering or anything. It's not like I know that you've been playing around with Clearwire.
Yeah. Well, so Clear actually, one thing I've loved about Clear, and I've been using Clear over the summer because I was in a place with a limited internet connection, or a shared internet connection in basically a hotel. So I was using Clear and
Spank Central. Didn't you say it was like all like porn all the time?
It's pretty. Well, I mean, you can imagine in a hotel. What I mean,
did you bring a black light?
Unless a hotel's internet is extremely well managed, it's almost impossible for it to act reliably.
Yeah, it's all pornography and malware.
Yeah,
that's pretty much all that ever goes on.
So I was in this situation, and in order to resolve it, I ended up subscribing to Clear. A Clear wireless internet, 4G. They use WiMAX to supply you with a 4G speed connection in some major areas. Seattle's one of them. San Francisco area is another. San Diego is not, unfortunately. When I went back to San Diego for a few weeks, my hotspot was entirely inoperable, which was a little disappointing. But my real complaint. So I was really happy with Clear over the summer. I pushed, you know, at some points I have probably 10 or 15 gigabytes of bandwidth a day.
Now
through.
Because you do a lot of Steam.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So I at one point I deleted my entire Steam library accidentally, or in trying to resolve an issue with it.
Internet professional Alan Joyce.
Yes, yeah, we're here teaching you how to not let technology ruin your day. So as a result, I actually had to re-download somewhere around like 80 gigabytes of data.
Oh,
yeah. But the nice thing about Clear was they just let me do that. All they do is they look at a specific point in time and they meter you based on how many people are using the tower that you're using, and they give you your fair share of that tower and nothing more. Which I think is really smart. That accounts for peak usage, and it doesn't have this whole idiotic bandwidth cap idea, which sort of modifies user behavior in order to fit within the bandwidth cap, which kind of resolves the peak usage problem, but it doesn't really address the problem directly, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's not their capacity they're fixing. They're fixing your behavior.
Sure, yeah. So Clear was really good over the summer, and I ended up I didn't want to. I knew I was only going to need it for a few months, so I didn't go for their typical plan where you commit to a 2-year term, just like a cell phone contract, and then you lease your device. Basically, you lease your hotspot, and then you send it back to them at the end of your term. Mm-hmm. I actually bought the hotspot outright for like $130, something like that.
What does it do? Like, is it 802.11n? Is it like dual band or?
I believe it is G. And it is up to 8 clients. It could not function as a hotspot for anything beyond their service though.
Okay.
So it's not like I'm buying something I can use outside of their service. It's specifically for use with Clear.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. But it was really nice, really compact device. I didn't mind buying it outright because I knew I was only going to use the service for a few months. And I opted for their what they call basically their month to month plan, or they even use the term pay as you go in a few places.
Okay.
And this gave me the impression it's the same type of plan as say Virgin Mobile, where you pay for internet when you need it, you get it for a certain amount of time, and then you no longer pay for it after that amount of time. And at any point, you can come back and say, I need another 10 days, I need another 30 days, whatever you need if you're going on a trip or something.
Sure.
Which is reasonable to expect, right?
Yeah, and that would kind of fit in line with your expectation of someone that uses the service when they travel or
sure.
things like that, right?
Yep. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Turns out, not so much.
Oh, all right.
So in order to stop your service, you have to actually call them, which is a step in the wrong direction, but not fatal, right?
Yeah, yeah. I had to call Mediacom today to cancel too. You know, they made me not. You know, I wish I was sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No. So whenever you have to call an internet related company in order to modify your service, there's already a problem there.
Yeah.
But in addition, it was the typical cancellation call where it's 10 to 15 minutes of, are you sure you want to do this? You know, we can offer you this and this and this. You could transfer your subscription to a friend.
Now I have a question. Nice offer. So when you first called up and said you'd like to cancel, now do they transfer you to a retention specialist or do you still talk to the same person?
No, they do. Yeah, they transfer you to another person who I'd assume is a cancellation specialist. Yes.
Yeah, no, they're a retention specialist.
Retention specialist, of course.
Their job is to keep you spending money. So
right.
All right.
So I go through this whole process, and the End result of it is basically now my service is canceled, which is fine because I don't need it at this point. But if I ever want to start using Clear Internet again, if I ever want to buy another month, I have to pay the $35 activation fee again.
Okay.
Which means I'm never, ever going to resubscribe to Clear.
Well, hold on a second. So now, could you have just left the account open, never used it, and paid nothing?
No, because I would have been on the hook for a monthly bill if the account was still open.
Okay, so the pay-as-you-go thing is not exactly pay-as-you-go.
No, it is not prepay, and then, of course, they wouldn't prorate the amount I'd already paid.
Oh, wow.
Because
did you tell them that you are the co-host of the Hell Yeah Show?
I did not drop that fact in there. But
that's a lot of influence, I found.
unlike you.
Yeah.
I need to learn to leverage this this
your celebrity status.
Yeah. So the whole process was just kind of frustrating and not what I'd expected when I got into this plan. And, you know, I guess I didn't read closely enough. I'm sure if I read closely enough or looked into it further, I would have noticed, hey, if I ever want to do this, what I'm envisioning, where if I'm on a trip or something, I can resubscribe, it's going to be this $35 activation fee and I'm going to have to commit to a month of service. And that is, I'm going to prepay that, quote unquote, but I'm actually committing to basically just a monthly service plan.
Okay.
So I'm pretty disappointed overall, even though I really like their service and I would totally subscribe again if they gave me the option to, I'm going out of town for a few weeks and I need some wireless internet. But it's not going to happen. Sorry, Clear.
That's really unfortunate.
Yep. Anyway, moving on though from our ISP troubles, unless you've got more.
No, I mean, just when I called Mediacom today, they said that they couldn't actually cancel service today, that I have to give them 7 days notice. And I said, you know that for the last 7 days, it hasn't worked at all, right? And she was like, well, yeah, but you're going to have to call back in 7 days to confirm that you want to cancel. And then we will refund you. And I'm like, so you're still going to keep me on the hook and you're going to make me pay for service that I'm still not getting, but you're also not going to let me cancel it today so that I'm not being billed for it. You're going to still require, she's like, that's just our policy. You know, it's like, when you leave 30 days notice, like if you're leasing an apartment, and I said, yeah, but I'm not leasing an apartment.
Yeah.
I'm getting internet service from you, or I was supposed to be, and I haven't been for the last week. So yeah, like it just, she wouldn't budge on that.
Sure. But, yeah.
So I mean, I think in 7 days, I'm going to have another phone call with somebody and I'm not going to be as cheerful as I was with her.
I think the overarching problem here is you have these companies that are providing these, what you expect to be a modern service, but their business techniques are antiquated.
It's not only that, but like they're not. See, I had the same back and forth with AT&T Wireless recently where I had a service issue where I had some Wi-Fi problems at work. And so I would routinely be using or trying to use the 3G data service on my iPhone. And the problem I was having is that my 3G data service was going at about 54K. And so I sent them a note, opened a ticket, and I complained. And I don't know if I sent you their response or not, but I sent back a response after that. Or basically the people from AT&T Wireless, their position is that they don't guarantee the service at all.
Sure.
So I'm not entitled to an expectation of it ever even working. And that's something that really needs to change. Like, I think beyond the business models and the weird practices and the old world thinking where they're, you know, they're running some sort of fantasy land, like, I think what really needs to change is, like, people need to start holding companies that provide a service like this to an SLA. Like, if you're a corporate customer or you have an agreement with someone that's a service provider for things like for internet connectivity or transit through another network or a big wireless bill, like, or like getting some sort of a big group plan together, you get some sort of an agreement and a guarantee from the company that they're going to provide a service. And I don't think consumers get that at all.
Yeah. And I think there are plenty of people out there that would be willing to pay a bit more to have something like that.
Yeah. And this smart ass from AT&T is like, well, we don't guarantee 100%. And I'm like, I'm not asking for 100%, but like, according to my math, like if this didn't work for a day, like that's not even like 99.9, right?
Yeah.
Like if there's a multi-day outage, you're dipping into the mid 90s.
Sure.
Like that's not even close to 100%. And that's a big difference, because if I'm anybody else spending any real money, like I'm only paying AT&T something like, you know, $150 a month. They don't care about me, right?
Yep.
But if I'm paying them $10,000 a month, then they start to care. But the reason that they're really caring is because you don't have to pay them that $10,000 if they don't deliver what they're contractually obligated to do. But right now, the only contract that I have with AT&T serves AT&T. It doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like my service contract with them is totally for their benefit. It's like the credit card companies have this legislation for security called PCI, and like your service has to be PCI compliant. And PCI does not protect merchants or consumers. PCI is only there to protect the banks and to let them have a way to sue people who don't do their due diligence and don't protect their service, or you know they get compromised or they don't protect your credit card data. Has nothing to do with protecting consumers. It has everything to do with protecting the image of MasterCard and Visa.
Well, speaking of ridiculous terms of service and agreements.
We got to talk about Sony. These SOBs.
Yeah. So there's a new terms of service for the PlayStation Network, which you basically have to agree to in order to use your PS3 online in any capacity.
Even to do Netflix or even to play a game that even if you don't go online with it, like it wouldn't let me start playing games or doing anything until I read the terms of service and agreed to it.
I believe if you completely disconnect your system from the internet, I think you can get by without agreeing to it.
Wow, that sounds great.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm going to go ahead and read part of this at least. Any dispute resolution proceedings, whether in arbitration or court, will be conducted only on an individual basis and not in a class or representative action or as named or unnamed member in a class, consolidated, representative, or private attorney general action. Basically, it's saying you cannot bring a class action lawsuit against Sony.
Yeah, well, they're making you agree that you will not and that you will opt for some sort of third-party arbitration rather than go to court.
Yes, which basically means settling it directly with Sony, not going through the court system at all, and it puts you at a significant disadvantage compared to what could potentially be a damaging class action lawsuit if there was something as large as, say, a massive security breach.
Now, here's my question to this, though. What stops, essentially, what would stop me and like 2,000 other people or 100,000 other people from filing small claims against them? Like, do they really think that they're going to be able to avoid having to send attorneys and paying fees and paying out judgments for 10,000 people?
I think this is less about accounting for every possibility and more just they have this one possibility of we may encounter a class action lawsuit if something like that massive security breach happens again. And there apparently was a recent case that went through the Supreme Court that affirmed that, or at least a high court, that affirmed that language like this can be upheld in court.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So it's basically
The Supreme Court did say that this type of an agreement is okay. But it does not – they don't block you or me personally from filing a suit.
Right.
And I think, you know, to be honest, what's the – you know, what am I going to be doing in a class action suit? Like,
sure.
Yeah, I'm going to get my $15. But,
in the mail,
But if
checks
you know,
in the mail.
Yeah, something actually happens and Sony does something and screws me, then I'll take him to small claims court. And yeah, I mean, I have kind of mixed feelings about this. I think it's a dick move on their part. They're basically flexing their muscle to force me to do something or to agree to not do something. Mm-hmm. Basically, they're saying, we're going to screw up again. Like, we're colossal F-ups. And like, there's no way that we're not going to be compromised. It's probably going to be worse next time. So we're going to do everything we can to make sure that you are not going to be able to run us out of town and string us up and set us on fire. Like, that's pretty much all they're doing.
So, and there's an interesting subnote in this, in that you can actually opt out of this language if you send a letter to Sony, it can't be an email, an actual physical letter to Sony within 30 days of agreeing to this language. If you send them a physical letter saying, wait, but actually not this part, then you can be involved in a class action lawsuit.
Well, I think everyone should do that then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if nothing else, that you should do it out of principle.
Yeah.
I mean, they should get thousands upon thousands of letters and have to sort through that, because then it will actually be more expensive for them to sort through all those letters than it would have been for them to defend a possibly baseless class action lawsuit.
And I'm kind of fuzzy too on like the class action thing, because I know that like anytime I've occasionally you'll get an email. I mean, if you've ever registered a product or something, you'll get some ambulance chaser that sends you an email that says like, "Attention, all customers of TiVo or whatever. Like, we are putting together a class action lawsuit." Blah 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 blah. Like the expectation of that has always been for me that if you are not one of the people who sets up the lawsuit, that your actual like judgment is very modest. Like,
sure, yeah,
a fraction of what the people bringing the suit, like the first dozen people or whatever. And I don't know if that's, you know, the way that class action suits work in general, or just how they typically pan out, or what.
I didn't know there was, or I've never heard anything about sort of the like the first dozen people or whatever get a higher settlement. I would think maybe their legal fees are covered, but I wouldn't know. I wouldn't think they'd get a higher payout than the rest of the people, because presumably they're all wronged in the same way, right?
You know what? We need to have Varo.
We do.
That. He'll Varo will know the answer. He's one of the, one of our dozens of listeners.
He's probably listening to this just screaming into his iPod.
Yeah. He's probably beating his fist against his steering wheel and raging as hard as he can. But yeah, hopefully we'll get the scoop on that.
All right. Very good. okay. Something we may know a bit more about here. Netflix is no longer just Netflix. This is a little scary.
this whole thing, and like that dude's like really embarrassing YouTube video.
Is this the guy, the Twitter guy?
No. Wait, the Twitter Quickster feed is the no smoking pot, right?
Yeah.
So Netflix splits off their DVD business into this thing called Quickster, and the problem with Quickster, of course, is that the Quickster user on Twitter is someone whose avatar is a Elmo from Sesame Street smoking weed and making a lot of really inane, bizarre stoner comments.
And I believe he is recently, I've got to look this up, I heard it somewhere, I believe he has recently been saying things like, you know, we're not going to make a deal until it's in the six figures.
Nice. Well, we all know that like, if they want it badly enough, they'll probably force him to do it.
So
own the name. Remember when Spin went up? Well, I don't know. He got to keep his name, right?
Yeah. Well, so Twitter does have some provisions. Like, actually, I work at the Stanford radio station KZSU, and we were able to get the KZSU Twitter handle back from a company that was basically putting songs from our playlists up there and linking to Amazon referral. Amazon referral IDs for those songs.
We were able to get enterprising young douchebag.
Yes, yeah, we were able to get that account taken down, and we were able to acquire the name for ourselves. But that's because we had the name before that account existed. Netflix didn't have the Quickster name until after this, unless they trademarked it years ago and didn't tell anyone. It's unlikely that they established that. Again, we are talking about things we don't entirely know about. But I'm guessing, since they don't have that established presence of that name, they can't go through the Twitter process of reclaiming it.
Did you see that Apple did not get the multi-touch trademark?
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just got denied the trademark on the term multi-touch that they put in the patent paperwork for in 2007 before the launch of the iPhone. And in that time, multi-touch has become a colloquialism, I guess, or
sure,
whatever the technology is. Yeah, another instance of Varo beating his head against the windshield.
we should stop talking legal talk here.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
I'm just reading through this guy's Twitter feed here. Netflix didn't take anything. This is Jason talking. And if you don't believe what WAT I say, or if you wanna start talking, then don't tweet about me.
Wow.
Okay, listen to this.
Wait, hold on a second. This he sounds like one of those kids that's on like the Jerry Springer show.
Like, I think he's in high school. Based on the stuff
he
says.
You don't know anything about me. But I want whatever I want to do whenever I want. Yeah, it's totally what I'm seeing.
I just got scared. I went into the shower, turned on the water, and then stuff started falling. I was like, oh my god, what? WTF? LOL. I do not recommend anyone to use drug, nor do I use them. They bring nothing good to your, you are, life. I never really thought by having a pick of...
We get this kid on the show.
I don't want to give this guy any more attention than well, he's already been given.
The funnier thing, though, I think, about the Netflix Quickster thing is like the really apologetic hat in hand email that we all got like
yep,
last
week. And there's a video online, too. Did you see the video?
Yes, and I watched that video on YouTube, and I swear to God, I was embarrassed. Like, I was like, are you kidding me with this? Like, I was seriously, I felt bad for the guy.
Yeah. To give people some background here, if you don't know, we actually talked about this in a previous show a bit. Netflix sort of raised their prices. They split off their plans, their DVD plans and their streaming plans into two separate things that you pay for. So you actually have to pay for each one individually instead of getting a combined package, which means instead of paying, I was paying like $12 a month, I ended up paying around $19 for both of them. So there was a price hike, which they handled arguably pretty poorly in sort of communicating what the reasoning was behind that and easing people into the new plans.
Yeah.
This move is kind of basically a trying to go back and rewrite that and apologize for it and presumably do things right this time. But I guess you think the rhetoric, the apologizing part came on a little strong.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of appreciated it, but at the same time, like, it was kind of embarrassing. And the guy, I don't know how they could have done it differently. Like, he shouldn't have done the video. I think is really what it comes down to. Like, maybe they should have, like, you know, put it in everyone's queue for instant streaming.
I'm a big fan of Reed Hastings. Actually, I think he's a great CEO.
Yeah, I don't know anything about him, but I just felt like it was a little. I don't know. It seemed a little saccharine. Well, I guess that's what it was, is that I felt like it was insincere because it was so, I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. So let's talk about this move overall, though. I think this is actually a pretty smart thing, turning the DVD business into this easily severable limb.
Okay.
Because there will come a time where the DVD business will no longer be as profitable and no longer be as desirable. And it's going to be this atrophied limb of Netflix that they're going to want to sell to someone, and that's a lot easier if it's this separate company.
Are you sure? Because the MPAA has told us, if nothing else, they will cling to a technology until their dying breath. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I was in a class today, and the professor said. It was talking about internet protocols and was saying BitTorrent, yeah, used to be really popular, has now been replaced by Netflix, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, there's some truth to that.
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you know, the MPA is probably a lot happier to have Netflix than to have BitTorrent.
Sure.
So,
I mean, obviously people are still pirating content. They're still distributing copyrighted material. However, I think that there has been a substantial dip in that, and I don't know that Netflix is entirely to credit for that, but I will say that they're very inexpensive and provide people with relatively instant access to a fairly substantial volume of things that people are interested in watching.
Yep.
So that's all win. And same thing with, you know, Amazon's service, and they're kind of ramping up. Is it this Wednesday? Do you expect a new tablet?
Oh, I actually was not keeping tabs on that, but I do know they just announced a bunch of new Fox content on Amazon Instant Streaming.
I think Wednesday is the day that people expect Amazon's new tablet. Maybe we could have like a special report or something if that happens.
All right. Yeah, well, we've been predicting that for a while. We're all on top of that.
Yeah. We are prophets and soothsayers. Yeah, who didn't see that coming?
Yeah, actually lost in the noise aspect of this Netflix Quickster deal is they will now be renting video games under the Quickster name. Does this tempt you at all?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I'm absolutely on an embargo on buying any new PlayStation 3 titles at all. Like,
okay.
I'm done. And I have been done since they since the compromise and their response to it. So everything that I've been buying lately has been secondhand, if at all. So the rental thing I've tried before. I had an account with Gamefly for a while.
I had a Gamefly account briefly.
Yeah, I don't know. I seem to, my game playing is pretty cyclical. So, I mean, there'll be a stretch, like there'll be a month where I have plenty of time and I, you know, make really heavy use of it.
Yep.
But then there's also, you know, 11 other months out of the year where I don't. So it didn't really make a lot of sense for me.
I mean, my problem with it is I play multiple games at the same time. I'll play part of a game and then leave it for weeks at a time and then come back to it. Yeah. It's not, it doesn't work as cleanly as a movie. A movie you can watch in 3 hours at most and be done with it and send it back, and that's an evening. A game can take place over multiple days, multiple weeks, multiple months even, which makes it a lot harder to coordinate those rentals in a way that's actually cost efficient.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I like the idea, and I think the Gamefly service has been working pretty well for them, but then there's things like OnLive where people are like doing this online streaming thing. There's some competition there. So who knows? Like, I don't know if it's going to be a great business for them or not, but I'm glad that it's available, if nothing else, because I don't think anyone was competing with Gamefly.
Sure. Yeah. No, they were standing on their own, and they actually are not that great at getting the DVD you want and getting it to you quickly. Those are two things they have not quite gotten down. And I know they've had some trouble with the post office. I believe they don't quite get the priority in.
Wasn't there some lawsuit or something?
Yeah, they either had a complaint or a lawsuit against the post office, and I believe it was resolved. But yeah, basically that their discs were not being handled as carefully and as quickly as Netflix discs.
Interesting.
Yeah,
they should have made their packaging red.
Right. Just disguise them. Yeah. So anyway, this will be interesting to watch. And I mean, I'm a big fan of Netflix. Been a subscriber for quite a while. And I don't plan on unsubscribing anytime soon. So hopefully Quixtar is going to be a really awesome service and is not going to make me want to unsubscribe, because currently I don't want to. So
I think that the next generation consoles, I mean, other than the new Wii, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, the next Xbox and the next PlayStation, that if a lot of the content that comes out for it isn't all distributed digitally and online.
Yep.
Mainly because they hate the secondhand market, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They've never liked it, and this would let them edge that out. Because you wouldn't be able to give it to somebody else anymore or resell it. And they would have, like, they would be able to effectively enforce a weird EULA on all of their end users.
Sure.
Which, I mean, I don't know how that's going to work out for them, but.
Yeah, yeah. All right, very good. Our main event here is talking about PC building, but before we get to that, I want a quick Jekyll update.
So I did all this work to move Kvetch onto Jekyll, and I was really happy with it, and then I realized that the things that I really liked about Jekyll were the same things that made it not as readily accessible. So I actually moved Kvetch to Tumblr, and now I've put incumbent.org onto Jekyll and started redoing some of that. So I kind of rearranged and shifted everything. It was kind of a fun exercise, if nothing else. But I kind of like Tumblr. They're down a lot, though. Like if you are if you're using like a custom domain name with Tumblr, there seem to be frequent outages with that. Like I have it behind Cloudflare, so at least. Even when Tumblr is down and not working, my site is still up and people can still get to it because Cloudflare serves it up for me. But something happens weird on their redirector for hosted domains over there.
Wow.
I don't know what it is, but like the regular Tumblr accounts are all fine. But like it wasn't just me. I mean, like the Patrick Rohn's Minimal Mac is also on Tumblr, and that's frequently down when my site's down. It's really odd, but you know, I don't pay them anything, so I can't really complain too much. But
sure.
I love the mobile Tumblr thing for the iPhone. It lets me post things really easily. I like it a lot. It makes it a lot more approachable.
So, but for sort of posting little news articles and bookmarks and that sort of stuff, you like that better?
A Jekyll site's not great for that. Jekyll's great for writing documents and publishing documents.
Right. Yeah.
It's not good for like snippets and the type of like spammy stuff that I do. Like, I don't know. Like, there'll be some days where I'll put like, you know, half a dozen to a dozen things up. And Jekyll's not great for that. Like, it's just, you know, the workflow isn't as accessible. So, having a nice front end and a nice mobile client for Tumblr lets me easily share things and put whatever I want whenever I want from anywhere. Jekyll requires me to be at a computer with a proper text editor, and that's good because if I'm writing something, it's great. But then there's another alternative to Jekyll called Nanoc, N-A-N-O-C, which is also written in Ruby. It's a little bit different. It's not designed necessarily for blogging. there's a lot of really cool things about Nanook that we could talk about that some other time. But
are you tempted to switch again though?
I was looking at it and I was really going through the motions and considering it, and then I can't remember what it was exactly, but I hit a wall with something really quickly, and then I was like, well, I know how to do this with Jekyll.
So
I just, I stuck. But Nanook is pretty cool. Jekyll's great, though, and I think there's more momentum there, and there's definitely more eyes on it.
Yeah, I've heard about it before.
Yeah.
Before you were talking about it, yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay, well, the main event this show, building a PC. It's not as hard as you think, actually. If I can do it, you can do it.
It's pretty intimidating for people, I think.
Well, so and I'm a computer science major. I deal with software pretty regularly. I don't deal with hardware that much, and found myself kind of at a disadvantage when I was thinking about building my own PC. And actually, at the end of the day, everything turned out really well.
So, did you have anyone like help you out on this project at all?
I talked to a few people who gave some recommendations on various hardware components and that sort of stuff. But the actual building was all me. So,
yeah, us Mac people, we don't know too much about computer. They're hard.
this project actually originally started from an issue with my Mac. My MacBook Pro, the dedicated graphics card, the NVIDIA 330M in my MacBook Pro, started flaking out to the point where it the screen goes black and the computer hard locks at random times.
No.
Yeah. It keeps you on your toes.
Is this related to the switching of the discrete NVIDIA versus the integrated
Intel?
No,
so it doesn't actually happen sometimes it'll happen on a switch, but I can be using the graphics card for an extended period of time, and it will happen at a random point in that extended period of time using the dedicated graphics card the whole way through. So I'm guessing there's some instruction or there's something that triggers it. Because it only happens in certain use cases, but in those use cases, it happens pretty reliably. Hmm. And like there are certain games that I know trigger it. People are saying if you do it in a certain pattern, if you open a photo booth and then try and apply an effect, it triggers it.
Sounds like it's that tells me that it's a bug with Quartz Extreme and OpenGL.
Yeah, I think it may be a software issue. Although actually, it happens on the Windows side too. So I think it may be an NVIDIA driver issue, because a lot of people actually are reporting that they didn't have it happen. And this is a very commonly known problem. There's like an 83-page Apple discussion board post about it. And people are saying they didn't experience it until they installed Lion, which was actually not my experience. But maybe I can't remember if maybe I had just seen it on the Windows side before Lion, and then probably Lion updated to the newer NVIDIA drivers, which may have introduced the bug.
There's also a change in, was it 10.7.1? There's kind of like a quiet GL bump happens in there
which
somewhere.
Did not help.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, unfortunately. It's been it was a big enough issue that I actually installed I forget what the program is called, GFX card status. which
What's
tracks
that do?
So it's a menu bar. Yeah, right. It's a menu bar item that shows you what your currently used graphics card is, whether it's integrated or dedicated, and or discrete. Sorry, not dedicated. And it allows you to actually force your computer to only use one or the other graphics card.
Oh.
So I forced my Mac to only use the integrated graphics card, which of course sucks. It's the Intel integrated graphics, which is terrible, and you can't actually use it to do any graphically intensive thing, but it works for normal computing use. It can play HD video, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's what my MacBook Air has. It's, you know, the Sandy Bridge integrated video.
Yeah, yeah. So I did that, but then I've no longer got a dedicated graphics card. So actually the cost to repair this, my computer's out of warranty, is actually that of a full logic board replacement, which is not even guaranteed to fix it because you're still replacing it with a 330M.
Yeah.
So, and a logic board replacement is somewhere between, $800 and $1,000.
All right, it's time to put that bad boy on Craigslist.
So I decided to build a PC.
Yeah.
For that amount of money. Well, a bit more, but
Well, not much, though, right?
Not like, much more. No,
for,
no.
For about $1,000, you can get a hell of a machine.
A little over $1,000, yeah. Yep.
So and what'd you get with the... Did you intend to run Windows or Linux or something
so,
else on
no,
this?
I intended to the whole way wanted to run Windows 7. I've been dual booting on my Mac for a while, mostly for playing games, also for tinkering around a bit with Windows development tools, it's been really good. It's the last Windows OS I ran was XP, skip
yow.
Vista, and I it's a market improvement over that, and I've actually found it really usable. So that's where I wanted to go with this PC, and maybe eventually a dual boot with a Linux distro of some sort, but not really sure yet. Currently, I'm pretty happy with it on Windows.
So. You know, you're running 64-bit, I'm sure.
Yes,
The Windows 7 64-bit is a pretty solid platform. I like it a lot. There's a lot of nice things about it, and the 64-bit version of Windows 7 also has some better protection against malware that you don't get on even the 32-bit Windows 7
side.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
Huh. Yeah, because a lot of the malware running around just doesn't run on 64-bit systems.
that's for starters. Yeah.
And then there's that improved memory protection that they have that's...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been really liking it, and I've... It's been great for playing games. I installed XBMC, which we'll talk about in a future show when we talk about home theater stuff. So I've been using it for some sort of media center home theater applications.
Have you done any like benchmarks on this with a video from like to compare it with your MacBook Pro to
well,
this machine?
I mean, it blows the MacBook Pro out of the water. there's no comparison there. I mean, stuff like
you're out of warranty. That thing's like 3 years old, right?
No, I mean, my MacBook Pro is about a year and a half old.
Oh, you didn't get extended AppleCare on it?
No.
Well, you're an idiot. Don't.
I know. So
I can't believe you didn't do that. Always. Okay, first, I got to stop. No, full stop. So I can make a lot of arguments for when you shouldn't get AppleCare, but a portable device is not one of them.
Yeah.
You should always, always buy AppleCare. Now,
I intend to in the future.
You're talking. Yeah. So okay. The problem here, while I'm continuing to scold you, is that if you're at all squeamish about it, you have a year to do it. So after you buy your new Mac, you have 12 months to buy AppleCare. So if you're a little short on the dough and the $300 is like, if you're hemming and hawing over it, just wait. Get it like 11 months later. Sometimes you can even buy it on Amazon cheaper, like a $300 AppleCare kit you can sometimes pick up for like, you know, $250 or whatever. And I think it's absolutely something you need to do, and Alan's a fool for not doing it.
Yeah, so I am operating and have operated up until this happened on the conventional wisdom going back since I bought an iBook in like 2001 of don't buy the extended warranty.
Well, The only time you should do that is if you know that you're not going to keep it for a year.
Yeah.
Which happens sometimes. Like I just when I sold my 11-inch, I only had it for like 8 months or whatever. But
sure,
I had AppleCare with it. But did I tell you they paid me in tacos?
Yes. Yeah. You mentioned that on the I think on the last show. Yeah.
Okay.
That you actually did get your payment though.
Yeah. The check cleared, and I went over and I met the owner of the restaurant, and it was lovely. And I have the ginormous gift certificate mounted to my wall, so if I needed to, I could survive on that gift certificate.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So getting back to the PC build, I'm just going to run through what I built, the components that I chose, and then we can talk about sort of the building process and your experiences doing this sort of thing as well. So it is Core i7, Intel Core i7, which is the most recent Intel chip, 2600K, which is the highest i7.
Is that the one you can overclock? Does it have an unlocked multiplier?
That is the one you can overclock. I have not overclocked it yet, and not sure I'm going to, but... I might, maybe a little. I'm not going to go nuts with it.
I wouldn't sweat it. Isn't your stock clock on that like 3.4 gigahertz and you have 8 cores available?
Yep, so. Precisely.
I think you'll be all right.
So, motherboard is Asus P8P67 Pro. And it's with this board, it's really important to get a revision 3. Actually, I'm at revision 3.1. You want the latest revision. There have been some problems with the earlier revisions.
Okay.
But the revision 3.1 board is actually, it's very cool. It's The BIOS supports mouse and keyboard, or keyboard obviously, but supports a mouse and has like a graphical user interface, which I thought was pretty interesting.
who made the BIOS? Do you remember?
Don't know. I mean, it's all ASUS branded, but not sure where the actual BIOS is from. And it's got all this like all these fancy graphics and things you would not expect in a BIOS. It's it's kind of cool. And makes overclocking very, very easy.
To be quite honest, I've sometimes found that configuring a BIOS is not as straightforward as you would think. And there's a lot of options, especially for hard disk controllers and things like that, I think a lot of people might gloss over. There's a certain mode, like the AHCI. Is that what you want to have enabled?
Don't know that, actually.
There's several options for the SATA disk controllers on most BIOS that you can either have it in like some IDE compatibility mode, or you can have it on AHCI, or you can enable Robson something or other for. There's all sorts of stuff.
One minefield when building a PC is acronyms.
Especially
there are a lot of acronyms involved.
There are a ton, and it's important to have like a guide and someone that you trust that. That can kind of sift through some of this, especially when it comes to configuring BIOS and clock multipliers and things like that.
So before I go any further, actually, let me say about guides. So I came into this with no experience actually putting all of the parts together. I know what all the parts do, but I don't know how to actually assemble them all, or didn't. And there actually are a couple great videos on tested.com. TESTED.com. Yeah, it's a tech review site. But they've put out a few videos that are each like an hour long and go through the entire process step by step and have good camera work, show every component, every screw going in, and really give you a good feel for. And they describe both what they're doing there and in the general case what you would do if you have different components that work in a different way that you need to install differently. It's really, really good. So I totally recommend that. Go to tested.com and just search for PC build. Look at the most recent video, and then I actually watched the most recent, and they do this on a yearly basis. They build a new PC every year. So
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard of that before. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. So that was really good. And that sort of gave me a lot of confidence in actually putting this thing together because I, as I said, had no clue. I could probably figure out what goes into what, but no clue about the more delicate aspects of putting it together. So
sure.
Power supply, Corsair HX850, 850 watts. RAM, 2 4-gigabyte sticks. ADATA DDR3, 1600 megahertz instead of 1333. Slightly overclocked RAM.
How many RAM slots do you have, and how much does the board support?
I have 4 RAM slots supporting up to, I believe, 32 gigs.
Nice.
I think. Yeah. I'm fine with 8, though. I have not I've not seen 8 used by the PC yet. So
I use 8. But I mean, also running Lion, and it's Lion loves memory. I think Windows is a little more frugal.
I've got 8 in my MacBook Pro as well, and it's gotten a little closer to it. But I still don't think I've always had at least half a gig free or so.
What do you got for a video card in there?
But in the PC?
Yeah, what'd you get?
It's an EVGA branded GeForce GTX 570 HD. So this is 1280 megabytes of VRAM, and
does it take up 4 slots?
It takes up it actually only takes up 2 slots. There are variants of this. Yeah, there are variants of this video card that take up 3. But this one by EVGA is actually EVGA is great. This is a really, really nice variant of this card. Fits into 2 slots has been working quite well.
How many outputs does it have?
It outputs via HDMI, dual DVI, and DisplayPort. You can actually get variants without DisplayPort, but I went for the DisplayPort one because I may end up buying a DisplayPort monitor at some point.
No, you won't.
Okay.
My Dell at work, my Dell Latitude docking station is the only thing I have that has DisplayPort. and then when I got a new monitor, it came into the office and it also has a DisplayPort. But like I so rarely use the Dell that I think I've used it twice. I don't know what it is, but like nobody seems to want to use it.
Huh. Anyway, I've got it there just in case.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
I primarily use the HDMI. So,
well, what's nice about the DisplayPort boards though is that then you can do triple head with one card, right?
Actually, yeah, I believe
HDI
so.
Cards. Yeah. HDI's iFinity, you have to have one display be DisplayPort.
Huh.
And I wonder if the NVIDIA chipset is similar.
Yeah, I've not looked into that. I prefer having one large high-resolution display as opposed to three or even two.
Since this is a Core i Sandy Bridge system, do you also have like onboard video?
Yes. So there is an onboard video card. I'm not using it at all.
So you could have like half a dozen monitors being driven by this thing.
But you know what? Actually, no. The motherboard does not support onboard video.
Oh, okay.
Because the chip does have,
yeah,
the chip has onboard video, but the motherboard itself does not support it. So,
okay.
Anyway, this graphics card is insane, though.
Sounds nice.
It's been a lot of fun to play around with, and hard disk. I went with dual 1 terabyte Western Digital Caviars, 720 RPM in a RAID 1 configuration. So RAID 1 is basically it provides backup.
It mirrors.
Yeah, right. So it right, yes. It mirrors and it provides. I believe it gives you a bit of a speed boost, right?
For reads, it actually will be a little bit slower on writes, but it will be faster on reads. And when you're playing games, that's usually what you want is fast read. You know, the quickest option, of course, would be to go with an SSD.
Yeah. I thought about that.
That can get real pricey, though, real fast.
Yeah, so I what I'm thinking is this
putting the OS on SSD is a really good move, though.
Yeah. So I was thinking getting 2 1-terabyte disks to start. I can maybe eventually move to a model where those are my media disks, and then the OS is on an SSD.
We should just real quick, an SSD is like using flash storage instead of spinning magnetic platters like a traditional hard disk has. And it's very popular right now for people with performance-oriented gaming machines and also sub-notebooks and ultralights that don't want to.
And if you buy any new MacBook Air, it's going to have an SSD in it.
Yeah, so there's no spinning parts. There's nothing that can, you know, break there, but it's not really a well-known technology yet, so we don't really know necessarily what the potential pitfalls are going to be in a few years, but it definitely is a lot faster for reads and writes because it doesn't have to move a spindle across a disk.
Yep. So optical drive, I just went with a basic CD-DVD burner because you can get them for about $12.
Yeah. And you got a sweet case, right?
And my case is amazing.
Take a picture. Did you put it up?
No, I should put I'll put up a picture of the case. Yeah. So it's a fractal design Define R3, and ATX mid tower. Oh, what's that?
That means nothing to anybody.
So it's this Swedish company, Fractal Design, and this is their first case in the U.S. Oh. And it is spectacular. You can get it off of Newegg. It is actually one of the expensive components. It's about $120. And it is so nice, so quiet. Everything is actually padded, so you do not hear the machine at all, which is incredible. It's got plenty of space for fans. I've only got three in there now.
Holy crap! This looks nice.
Yeah. Oh, it's so nice. And it's all the drive bays are metal instead of plastic, and they all have rubber dampeners on them, so that vibration doesn't become an issue.
I like this.
Yeah, it's all, and it's really minimalist too. There's no flashing lights or, you know.
Yeah, that's the worst part about building a PC, really. Like, no kidding. They all look hideous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, when you see some, it's like a 17-year-old kid in your neighborhood that has the Honda Civic with like the giant 8-foot wing on it.
Yep.
That's like 90%
exactly
of all PCs out there.
And even like the stuff like the blinking hard drive light.
Oh.
I don't need that. So this case just does not have that.
It looks beautiful. I like
it's fantastic. It's so good. It's minimalist. It is very high quality. All the components feel really, really nice. It's got plenty of holes for cable management. Plenty of space inside for everything I wanted to put in there. For a couple of the super high-end graphics card, you may not be able to fit it into this case, but for the 570, it was fine, which is not super high-end, but pretty high-end. And it's been working really well and performing great with an incredibly minimal amount of noise. So
that sounds awesome.
Yep, yep.
And everything's all tight and snug and fits together. And
yes, well, actually, that is probably the last thing I want to talk about here. Is I shipped this. I built it up in Seattle. I had to ship it via UPS. And I didn't want to ship all the components separately in their own boxes because that's a big pain. So I shipped it fully assembled, and it actually got to its destination. And the CPU fan had two of its mounting pegs had come loose, which is not a good sign.
Oh man!
And a few screws on the motherboard had come a little loose. No damage at all, but it did mean that I had to reattach the CPU fan, which is actually it's intended to come off under stress. It's not like this damaged the motherboard in this process. But there's this initial application of thermal grease that comes with it. It's already applied to the cooling unit. You just put the cooling unit on the CPU. Once the CPU is inserted in the motherboard, the cooling unit snaps into the motherboard, and you're good to go.
Hooray!
Yes, but the problem is, if it ever becomes loose or you need to replace it, you're going to have to reapply the thermal grease. So I had an adventure in reapplying thermal grease, which is actually not that bad.
Was there a walkthrough on
Tested?
On the website?
Yeah. Unfortunately not, but I found a walkthrough on another site. I forget what the site was, but it's a fairly straightforward process. Get some rubbing alcohol, get a lint-free cloth, wipe off the existing thermal grease, put a dab, a BB-sized dab of the new thermal grease in the center of the chip, put the cooling unit down, and you're good to go.
So not a dollop.
Well, you might. It's almost into dollop territory, but it is more on the side of bead, I would say.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Like pearl-sized?
Smaller.
Okay. Well, definitely not a dollop, then. A dollop is like a spoonful.
Okay. Well, if it's coming out of a very small thermal grease application tube, then a dollop it takes a whole lot to get a dollop out of that. So
I would imagine.
Yeah. As far as thermal grease goes, I think it's on the verge of bead and dollop. Anyway, and I got the thermal grease at Radio Shack, which was a fantastic experience because they had no clue what it was. So I was actually in the store on my phone looking up the different thermal grease types, trying to figure out which one I wanted, because the sales associate didn't know. And then once I figured it out, I actually told him,
yeah,
you know, here's what ceramic is, here's what silver is, here's what...
yep.
And he actually seemed grateful for the explanation, but I think Radio Shack seems to be a lot about selling cell phones at this point.
Yeah,
not
think
so much about thermal grease.
Yeah, the odds and ends and the DIY crowd kind of intimidates a lot of the people at Radio Shack, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, but the moral of the story is building PCs not that hard. Even reapplying thermal grease not that hard. You can totally do it yourself. It saves a lot of money. You get a much better machine, and you get a machine where you know what all the components are. You know how to replace them if you need to. You know what an upgrade path would be for an individual component if, say, a year down the road, you want a new graphics card or you want another hard drive or that sort of thing. You have control over your own computer, which is quite powerful.
I agree. It sounds like a really fun project, and I think that it sounds like you got a pretty sweet build. That case in particular is a pretty baller.
Yep. Are you going to be switching that case?
No. Well, I can't switch because my machine that I built is a shuttle. So it's like a very small cube-shaped box.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So I could, theoretically, I could, transfer the components into another machine, but yeah. I would probably just build a new one.
And this is actually, this is a fairly big case. It's not huge. As I said, can't hold a super, super high-end graphics card, but it's a pretty significant case.
Yeah, it looks hefty.
Yeah, yeah. All right, very good. I think that'll do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. Next week, tune in, because we're going to be talking about home theater. We have all sorts of great stories and advice on home theater stuff. And other than that, we will see you next week.
Yeah. I'm Emery.
I'm Alan.
See you next time.
See you next week.